The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I want to welcome you to this session tonight. My name's Paul Duffy. The Free Library is dedicated to advancing literacy, guiding learning, and inspiring curiosity at its 54 libraries throughout Greater Philadelphia. If you value this institution as much as Bernadette and I do, please consider making a donation to the Free Library Foundation. The foundation supports many of the library's incredible programs, like tonight's. You can visit freelibrary.org/support and make a donation. Okay, so it's an honor for me to introduce my friend Steve Jimenez. We met at Georgetown back in the day in classes with Tom King, a noted Jesuit theologian and philosopher. Byrne tells me I should just say that we were two naughty boys who gave Father King fits, and Father King would likely agree with that. But he also always encouraged us, and there are a couple of other Georgetown alum here tonight, to act from principle and move from intention. And if I can tell you anything about Steve, it is that he took that to heart. And in that amazing heart of his, he is committed to honoring what is true. Steve has been relentless and steadfast in that regard. This dedication of his took its first step in Steve determining what it is that was most true about himself. And as his avocations have moved into the world, he's never once equivocated in the face of the existential or ethical challenges that were in front of him. As some of you know, Steve has been a frequent visitor to Philadelphia. In the course of these visits, he wrote and directed a film about the families of the young men from Edison High School who lost their lives in Vietnam. Of all the films that have been done about that war, none have come as close as Steve's to casting a light on the dignity, the honor, and the integrity of these families, as well as their fallen children. For Steve, it was a question of presenting their dignity with piety. This is what Steve does. He is not, never has been, one for easy answers or half-truths. When he began looking into the Matthew Shepard case, I knew that Steve wasn't just pursuing a murder story. Something else laid unspoken, but Steve had heard it. Dispatches from him would arrive, sometimes to Tom King, sometimes to me, sometimes to his family and loved ones. And I recall an evening with Tom King in which both of us were quite worried about where Steve's pursuit was leading him. When you read the chapter in his book about the encounter at the truck stop, you'll understand our concern. Regardless of those frightening moments, there was a truth to be served, and Steve fully intended to honor that service. Tonight, I hope you'll engage my friend, engage his mind, engage his intrepid heart. He is a dialectical thinker. He lives to examine, to consider, and then to articulate. This is an extraordinarily well-written book, and much as he did years back with the film about Edison High, Steve has cast a light on the dignity, honor, and integrity of the tragedies within this story. There's certainly the tragedy of Matthew Shepard and Aaron McKinney, competitors in a highly charged crystal meth trade in Laramie, who also happen to be gay and bisexual, respectively. There is the tragedy of Russell Henderson, who should have restrained McKinney and who is doing life in prison in spite of playing no intentionally active role in Matthew's death. And there is the tragedy of Laramie itself, which willingly assumed the shame of being labeled homophobic instead of resolving a murder that implicated the drug money that intimidated both the town and its legal system. The ethical tragedy of Laramie is not unlike the ethical tragedy we see around us today. We know the difference between right and wrong. We know the importance of compassion as both a moral principle and as a survival mechanism. And yet we buy into the sanctity of such myths as a free market capitalism or security, and we all know that a market has no brain. We know that we're being watched from everything from the ATM at Wawa to the NASA in our telephone and data records. We capitulate to this, and yet at the same time, these things began in very small places. Part of what Steve's book has done is turn the camera back to the late 90s as this compromise was first taking root and first showing its bleeding edge. I was listening to Dylan on Sunday, and I thought that this verse must have rung an alarm in my friend. Come writers and critics who prophesize with your pen. Keep your eyes wide, the chance won't come again. Don't speak too soon, for the wheel's still in spin, and there's no telling who that it's naming. Steve has written a controversial and challenging book. I hope you will challenge him. Steve is a 2012 Norman Mailer Nonfiction Fellow and has written and produced programs for 2020, Dan Rather Reports, Nova, Fox, and a number of other television programs. His accolades include the Writers Guild of America, the Mongerson Award for Investigative Reporting from Northwestern, an Emmy for the film about Edison High, and several fellowships at the U Cross Foundation, Wyoming. Steve has taught screenwriting at NYU's Tisch School and at other colleges. Would you please welcome my dear friend, Steve Maness.
Good evening, and thank you so much for coming. What I'd like to do first is tell you a little bit about how I came to this story. And I know that a number of you have read the book, but let me just give you a little bit of a summary, because originally I went to Laramie, Wyoming, to write the story of the anti-gay murder as I believed it at the time and as so many of us believed it. Eventually, my decision to write this book was not to try to say this was not an anti-gay hate crime, but it was to look at many of the other human complexities that were part of this story. But I went to Laramie in early 2000, and this was after the trials were over. Aaron McKinney, the principal perpetrator, he was convicted and sentenced to two life terms in November of 1999. And it was in February of 2000, a couple of months later, that I went to Laramie. Like many people everywhere, certainly a lot of gay people, but I think Americans and people all over the world, I was horrified by this crime when I first heard about it, the grotesque violence of it, you know, the fact that Matthew essentially was beaten to death, that his brain stem was crushed, where the crime happened, all of that really stirred me. But it was not that first drew me to Laramie. What drew me to Laramie was, at the time of Aaron McKinney's trial and conviction, Dennis Shepard, Matthew's father, spoke in the courtroom on the day McKinney was sentenced. And he made a really eloquent and very moving statement. And, you know, you have to picture the setting at the time. There were satellite trucks out on the street, you know, media everywhere, and the world was really waiting to hear how this case was going to resolve itself. And Dennis Shepard was really, in a way, probing his own soul for clues. And he asked, I'm paraphrasing here, but his exact words are in the book. He said, why wasn't I there when Matt needed me most? Why wasn't I a better father and friend? And how will I ever get an answer to those questions now? And there was something about that that certainly spoke to me, and I think Dennis's words spoke to sons and daughters everywhere. I think he was also speaking for parents everywhere. There was something about what the cost of this murder was for that family and also for that community that really grabbed me. And so it was that prompted me to go to Laramie. I was interested, I was going at that time to research a screenplay for a made-for-television movie. And the entire court record had been under seal for a year, from the time the crime happened until after Aaron McKinney was convicted. No journalist could inspect any of the public record in the case, and all the witnesses in the case had been under a court-imposed gag order. That gag order not only covered witnesses, but it also covered all the other principals in the case, law enforcement, people that worked in the courthouse, the staff people for the defense attorneys. So at the time I arrived, the story was considered over. It had ended November of 1999. The media had left town believing the story was over with McKinney's conviction, and yet no one had really ever inspected the record in the case. During my first visit to Laramie, in fact, the first day I was in the courthouse going through reams of court documents, I noticed the prosecutor in the case. His name is Cal Ruruka. I had seen his picture in news stories, in the newspaper, and I recognized him, and I just asked him if he had a few minutes to talk about the case, and he said yes. And that first meeting, we spoke for about 45 minutes. And my impression of him was that he struck me as someone with real integrity, but he was very cautious. I could see that he even asked. He really wanted to know what my motives were for writing the story. He had had a very close relationship with the Shepherd family during the court proceedings, and he was very protective of them. And he said to me, "I won't have anything to do with any effort that is going to inflict more pain on Matthew Shepherd's family." So I left that day and I said, "You know, would you educate me? Would you help educate me about the case?" And he agreed to do that. And so over the next several months, I did many phone interviews with him, usually lasting anywhere from an hour to 2 hours. I came back east. And then I also returned to Laramie and continued interviewing him and talking to other people in the town. And during this period, I would occasionally hear rumors, some from law enforcement, some from people in the town, there's more to this case, but I didn't really have anything substantial to go on. I finished a first draft of the script in October of 2000, and I returned to Laramie with the draft of the script, and I asked him, Cal Ruruka, if he would read it and go through, make any comments if I had misstated anything, if there was anything that was inaccurate or false, to please write notes in the margins so that I could correct those things before I sent the screenplay to a producer in Los Angeles with whom I was working. So on a Saturday in October, he went through the screenplay. He sat in his office at one end of the hall, and I sat in a law library down the hall. And I thought this was going to be my last research trip to Laramie for the screenplay, because I had made many copies of things, I had taken a lot of notes, and I had done quite a number of interviews. And I was going through some stacks of not just court documents, but news clippings. His mother had accumulated several folders of news clippings, and I had my own collection at this point from the national media, but I wanted to be sure that if there was anything I had missed from Wyoming newspapers, that I would have it. And as I was going through these folders, there was a letter, a handwritten two-page letter tucked into a stack of news clippings. And the letter, and it's in the book, so I won't trouble you with reading it now, but in essence what the letter said was that the gay panic defense that Aaron McKinney used at trial was completely false. That Aaron McKinney was really familiar with gay guys, gay bars, that he it made allegations about his own sexuality, that he had been with other men sexually. And what really caught my attention was there was mention in the letter of a kind of notorious figure in Laramie, a limousine driver by the name of Doc O'Connor. For those of you who may have seen the HBO version of the Laramie Project, Doc O'Connor was played by the actor Steve Buscemi. And the letter mentioned Doc O'Connor by name, and it mentioned that Doc O'Connor was one of Aaron McKinney's gay friends. And the reason this caught my attention is because at that point, I hadn't met Doc O'Connor yet. I did later. But I had read enough about him and knew that Doc had become a friend of Matthew Shepherd, and here was mention of him in connection with Aaron McKinney. So, you know, that was the beginning when I found an anonymous letter, realizing that this was not a source that was credible, you know, in terms of journalism, and certainly wouldn't be admissible in a court proceeding as legal evidence. But there was enough information that I thought I really need to look into this further. So I set the screenplay aside and I began investigating. In the year 2001, I did a lot of investigation on my own, independently, made more trips to Laramie and began looking into things. I reached out to the two men convicted of the murder, Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson, and got basically the first interviews with the two of them. To date, really the only other person that's interviewed them is someone from ABC News 2020. They haven't been interviewed by other journalists. By 2002, I had gathered enough information, raising enough questions, that I took the story to the New York Times Magazine. And the New York Times Magazine commissioned me to write an investigative article on the Shepherd murder. I went on and worked on that story for about 2 years, making many trips back to Laramie, made trips to the prison to visit McKinney and Henderson, and traveled actually fairly extensively in that period. At the end of 2 years, well, let me backtrack. The editor who commissioned the story, Adam Moss, who's really one of the most distinguished editors in New York, left the New York Times Magazine. He's now the editor of New York Magazine. And so my story, I think, was a bit of a hot potato, and the Times killed it, really without any explanation. In fact, they said, "We really like your reporting, and we'd like to work with you on something else." At the same time that I was talking to the Times Magazine, I'd been talking to ABC News 2020 about the possibility of doing a story maybe in conjunction with the Times Magazine story, and I felt for sure that ABC News 2020 would lose interest when the magazine killed the story. What actually happened is the executive producer of 2020 said, "No, let's do this and let's give it an hour," based on a lot of the material that I investigated for 2 years for the New York Times Magazine. So that was 10 years ago. When I finished the Times story, I mean, when I finished the 2020 story, excuse me, in late fall of 2004, there were still a number of unanswered questions. We suggested in the piece that it really appeared that Aaron McKinney, the principal perpetrator who actually killed Matthew, that he and Matthew knew each other. And we suggested in the piece how they might have known each other through some of the same party circles, some of which revolved around the drug crystal meth. But we didn't really go into the relationship between them very far. So after the 2020 piece aired, I felt that I wanted to do more reporting and that I wanted to follow through with some sources I had used in the ABC piece and then go on and look for some other sources, and that's what I did. I haven't worked on the story exclusively over the last 9 or 10 years. There were other projects and other things, but this was something that I really felt there had not been a major nonfiction book on this case, and I felt that it was a case of great historical significance, and what I was learning I felt was very important. And that's really kind of the background of the book. I'm going to read a couple of short passages, and then what has been most interesting for me on the tour. This is city number 35 on a national tour. What has been most interesting for me are the questions and the conversations that have come about. So I'd like to sort of spend the bulk of the time there. But what I will tell you, for those of you, well, for all of you, even if you have read the book, is that what I discovered, a couple of things I discovered. One is that, well, actually, I think what I'm going to do is just read you a short passage from the book. For those of you who don't remember the sort of the official accounts that came out at the time when the murder happened, I'm just going to give you a very brief summary here, and then I will tell you some of the things that I did find out. This is from actually chapter one. It's on the first page. From the very first reports of the October 6th, 1998 attack, major news organizations provided a generally uniform account of the crime and the motives behind it. A sampling of newspaper and magazine stories painted a harrowing picture. First, the Boston Globe. Shepard, 2022, a first-year student at the University of Wyoming, paid dearly, allegedly, for trusting two strangers enough at the fireside lounge to tell them he is gay. What followed was an atrocity that forced the stunned community of Laramie to painfully confront the festering evil of anti-gay hatred as the nation and its lawmakers watched. The Denver Post. Police investigators turned up the following sequence of alleged events. Sometime Tuesday night, Shepard met Henderson and McKinney while at the fireside bar and lounge. Shepard told them he was gay. They invited him to leave with them. All three got into McKinney's father's pickup, and the attack began. Newsweek. Hungry for cash, perhaps riled by Shepard's trusting admission that he was gay, they drove to the edge of town, police say, pistol-whipped him until his skull collapsed, and then left him tied like a fallen scarecrow or a savior to the bottom of a cross-hatched fence. The Washington Post. Albany County Sheriff Gary Poles, who suggested that the beating was being investigated as a hate crime, said the investigation is aggressively continuing. Laramie Police Commander Dave O'Malley told the Associated Press that while robbery was the main motive, Shepard was targeted because he was gay. Time Magazine. What people mean when they say Matthew Shepard's murder was a lynching is that he was killed to make a point. So he was stretched along a Wyoming fence, not just as a dying young man, but as a signpost. When push comes to shove, it says, this is what we have in mind for gays. And finally, the New York Times. While some say gay leaders saw crucifixion imagery in Mr. Shepard's death, others saw a different symbolism, the Old West practice of nailing a dead coyote to a ranch fence as a warning to future intruders. So what I discovered over time is that Aaron McKinney and Matthew Shepard were not strangers, that they'd had a friendship for many months prior to this crime. From everything I've been able to investigate, Russell Henderson, the accomplice, had never met Matthew Shepard before that night. In fact, and this was, I found this interesting, is in fact, Aaron McKinney and Matthew Shepard had been friends longer than Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson. Aaron McKinney, early in the summer of 1998, got out of jail. He had, several months earlier, committed a burglary, fled for a period from Wyoming to Florida, and was brought back, fled from Wyoming to Florida, and was finally brought back to Wyoming. And he was in jail early in the late spring, early summer of 1998. He got out of jail, and his best friend introduced him to Russell Henderson, and McKinney was looking for a job. And Russell Henderson agreed to talk to his employer and help McKinney get a job. This was early that summer. While investigating, I learned that, in fact, Matthew Shepard and Aaron McKinney had known each other not months before. They had known each other in Denver. They had socialized together. One of the people they had socialized together was Doc O'Connor. There's a source in the book, a longtime friend of Matthew, someone that knew Matthew since Matthew was in high school, who had also socialized with Aaron McKinney and Matthew previously. So they were not strangers, as all of the national media reported. They were also, sadly and tragically, and nothing I can tell you tonight or nothing I've written in the book takes away from the grotesque violence of this crime and the tragedy and what happened to Matthew Shepard. But they were both really involved in the world of crystal methamphetamine. I'm going to mention something here that's of a more personal nature, but I think I want to give you a little bit of context. I've been out as a gay man since the 1970s. And beginning in the 1983, 84, the first cases of AIDS began to hit in New York City. By the end of that decade, I would say probably I lost maybe 75% of all of my gay male friends who got sick and died within a very short period of time. It's very different now. HIV means something different. As you know, there are all these different kinds of treatments. But at that time, when you got sick, it was really a matter of months. And I lost many, many friends. In the course of working on the Shepherd story, I really began to educate myself about meth. And I went to some of the leading experts in the country. I was interested in learning about the psychology of it, what happens with long-term meth use. In the case of Aaron McKinney, Aaron McKinney had been a meth addict for 3 years prior to this crime. He was a dealer. And he was also up for a week on meth before this crime happened. He'd been using it every day and a little bit mixing it with cocaine, but he'd been up on meth for a full week prior to the night of this crime. So I did some research on those aspects of meth, but one of the things that really grabbed me was when I discovered that there were studies being done showing that there were higher rates of HIV transmission among people using crystal meth than there were among the regular gay population. And the reason is, if you know anything about meth, this is a drug that makes you feel, initially anyway, 100 feet tall. You feel indestructible. It makes people that feel powerless feel like they have some power. And when I realized that this was contributing to the spread of HIV and that the meth epidemic was coming, had come on the heels of the AIDS epidemic, I was really horrified by it. And it was one of the reasons that compelled me ultimately to keep working on this story. When I realized that Matthew had gotten pulled into the world of crystal meth. In Matthew's case, Matthew lived in Denver in 1997 and 98, right before he moved to Laramie. And I was able to track down friends, people that he was involved with, socialized with in Laramie before moving to Denver. Some of them had grown up in Laramie, but were living in Denver, and some of them moved back and forth. So that's one of the things I learned, was what the role of methamphetamine was in this crime. And at the time, if you go back and look at the original media reports, there's almost no mention of methamphetamine. The only reporter who really tried to dig into it, and I think in many ways was the most honest reporter covering this story, was Joanne Vipijeski. And she wrote, at that time, she wrote for Harper's Magazine. She wrote pretty extensively. But Joanne, like the other reporters, was hampered by the fact that she didn't have access to those gagged witnesses, and she didn't have access to those court records, police reports, witness statements, all of those things. But I have here, I really like, Joanne wrote a short piece on the book for The Nation a couple of months ago, and it's a two-line quote, but I think it says a lot about why this case got perceived in the way it did at that particular moment in time, and I'll expound on that just a bit. But she said, "The murder was so vicious, the aftermath so sensational, that the story first told to explain it became gospel before anyone could measure it against reality. That story was born in part of shock and grief and the fact that gay men, like Shepherd, have been violently preyed upon by heterosexuals." And what I'll say is, in just to provide a little bit of historical context, let's look back at the year this crime took place, the fall of 1998. First of all, the dragging death of James Byrd Jr. happened in Texas 4 months before the attack on Matthew Shepherd in Laramie. So there was a country very sensitive to hate crime. There was a hate crime bill that was then stalled in Congress. The previous spring, also in 1998, some religious right conservatives, you know, there was an ad campaign about how, you know, homosexuals, gay people could go straight. You know, all you have to do is just go to a few weekend workshops and pray to Jesus and you're going to be converted to being straight. Trent Lott, then Senate Majority Leader, talking on television, you know, according to his reading of the Bible, that gays are sinners. Pat Robertson, famous quote at the time, homosexuality is the last step in the decline of Gentile civilization. So the gay community that year was under siege for many reasons. And when this crime happened, when the news went out that this horribly violent crime had happened, it became cemented as reality before the police had even completed an investigation or before anyone could even look into the circumstances of what had really happened. Also, by way of context, in 1998, when Matthew Shepard was attacked, what became a national meth epidemic had started moving through Midwestern states, Missouri, Kansas, Iowa, and was moving west, Nebraska, Montana, Wyoming, Colorado. This was already becoming an epidemic. When I was doing my research, I ended up interviewing a drug dealer in Laramie. He ended up going to prison and serving a federal prison term for meth trafficking. He was one of the first people. He brought meth to Laramie from Arizona in 1993. At the very same time that this epidemic started moving through those parts of the country, there was a meth epidemic that had started in certain urban gay enclaves, and this was also the relative beginning of that epidemic. San Francisco, L.A., New York. It was already a problem in Denver in 1997 when Matthew was living there, and it ended up spreading and becoming an issue in other urban gay communities beyond the three or four major cities that I just mentioned. But this was an epidemic that if you look back, you'll see that the national media did not really begin to look at this in any kind of a serious way until 2004, 2005, 2006, 2007. 2004 was really the beginning of it, but Matthew was murdered in 1998. And, you know, when I started researching, you know, who were the other people in jail with Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson at the time all of this happened? And I started to look at the charges. Many of those charges of the people that were in jail with them at the time were meth-related charges. It was already a big problem there. It got so bad that 70% of crime in the years after the attack on Matthew, 70% of crimes in the state of Wyoming were being directly attributed to meth use. It had the highest per capita rate of meth abuse in the nation, and it still has that dubious distinction. So this was something that I thought was an important element in this story. And it's not all that the book is about. I think the book also reveals human sides of Matthew that I don't think we've seen before. I was motivated by the fact that in the course of my research, reading so many magazine articles, seeing documentaries, news reports, etc., Matthew was conspicuously absent. He was not a presence there. It was the same three or four facts repeated over and over again. He had gone to boarding school in Switzerland. He spoke a few languages. He was a snappy dresser. You know, he was a sociable guy. But there wasn't much else. And so, you know, I tracked down quite a number of Matthew's friends. There are, you know, a couple of boyfriends he had, people he had fallen in love with, college classmates, friends that are in the book. And I thought allowing more of Matthew's humanity, the complexities of who he was as a human being, that was important to me to bring that into the story and to give some senses of why he might have gotten caught up in the world of crystal meth. But I think what I'd like to do is to open this up to some questions and answers and comments, and then what I can do is if there's a passage that's appropriate a short passage for me to read in connection with your question, I will do that. But would love to hear any comments and questions. That's sort of the short form version. Yes.
I find it so hard to believe that during the trial that it didn't come out that they were friends, Aaron and Matthew.
Well, a couple of things about that. One is that Aaron McKinney was a closeted bisexual. He was living at the time, he had a live-in girlfriend, and they had a newborn son. The son was 4 months old at that time. So Aaron McKinney was not out. He engaged in his activities somewhat surreptitiously, both in Laramie and also when he went to Denver. That's one thing. But the bigger reason is that what was really going on that night, the night of the crime, was there was a rivalry between two drug factions, two drug groups. Aaron McKinney's group was Wyoming-based, and Matthew Shepard's was Denver-based, even though Matthew's group, some of the people came from Laramie, and there was competition over who was selling meth in Laramie and, you know, selling in local bars, et cetera. But Aaron McKinney was covering for some of the drug suppliers that were higher on the, let's say, the drug food chain. I was able to find one of his suppliers on the night of the crime. He had already taken a plea in a federal meth trafficking case and was awaiting sentencing, and his sentence hadn't been assigned yet, and he had already pled guilty and made a deal. And on the night of the crime, Russell Henderson, Aaron McKinney, and one of the secondary characters went to this dealer's house on the night of the crime. Aaron McKinney was absolutely adamant about keeping the names of his drug suppliers out of this case. He's acknowledged that to me in interviews, and I've had that confirmed by multiple sources. Well, what I've learned is that, first of all, people in law enforcement in Laramie had investigated Aaron McKinney on other drug-related offenses, Aaron McKinney and his band of cohorts. They knew Aaron McKinney was involved with meth. Because the prosecution believed that the defense would try to use meth as part of the strategy, the prosecution tried to keep any mention of methamphetamine out of their side of the case. Okay, they were also concerned about talking with the media because they were afraid of a mistrial. Yes?
Is it your speculation that the drug people paid off Aaron McKinney and they put aside some money for him to take the fall, to conceal that?
You know, I've never been able to find any evidence of that, but I will say that psychologically, Aaron McKinney is someone who, since he was arrested, he has kind of thrived some on his notoriety. I think he's smart enough to know that it would be very dangerous for him had he snitched on anyone. But now, once he got the two life sentences, he's kind of thrived on being a notorious criminal. As far as any money being set aside for him, I've never found any evidence of that. But I do know the people that he was involved with that supplied him. One of them actually did get caught and is now away. He got something like a 65-year prison sentence. But there are other people Aaron McKinney was involved with who are walking the streets free today. Yes? There's someone in the back there.
Wasn't Matthew's mother going around the country portraying him as a tragic hero to rally round? When did she find out the truth about him?
Well, I don't know that she was portraying her son in heroic terms, in that she has acknowledged publicly a number of times and has even, she wrote a memoir called The Meaning of Matthew, acknowledged that Matthew had issues, but I think the extent of it was she referred to him self-medicating, didn't really say self-medicating with what, but she has never really said that he was heroic. But I do think that once the story that I described, the official story, got out there very, very quickly, that mythology became cemented, and he certainly did take on an iconic status and the status of a martyr. Yes.
Paul Duffy, who introduced you.
Mike.
Sorry. I
just recognized you. I'm sorry.
GU friend. raised the question about how could Laramie be seen as the homophobic place it was versus, I guess, fess up to the fact that of the, you know, how the drug cartel had seized the mentality of the town, or was it that dynamic in place? What made Laramie so quiet and let themselves be seen as a homophobic place?
Well, the people that were doing the direct communication with the media were essentially law enforcement. And I wouldn't go as far as to say the cartel got hold of town, because there were many forces involved here. And, you know, with Aaron McKinney's drug group, sometimes they would import them in from the West, from California. In Matthew's Denver group, sometimes it would come from the South. But the thing is that some of the police officers in the case have acknowledged that, you know, seven years before this crime happened, meth was already becoming a problem, and they weren't paying enough attention to it. I've been fortunate in that the prosecutor in the case that I met at the beginning, Cal Ruka, has acknowledged on the record that this crime was about methamphetamine, and has said if methamphetamine had not been involved, Matthew Shepard would be alive today. But what I've noticed with law enforcement is that there are the law enforcement people that are willing to be honest and tell the truth, and there are some law enforcement people that are less so and have not been willing to tell the truth. And I think that that's something you're going to find in Laramie, Wyoming, and you're going to find here in Philadelphia, and you're going to find in New York, New York. I have to say, I have spent a lot of time in Laramie, and I don't find Laramie any more homophobic than I have found any other community in America. And I certainly, my concerns there were really around the criminal underworld or law enforcement, not that I was going to get hurt because I was gay, once I really started to spend time there.
What kind of reactions have you gotten in bringing out this truth? People who just perhaps, because it become such a notorious hate crime, not wanting to believe the complexities. Yeah.
Well, the reactions have been, they're not static. They have been evolving over time, and at the beginning, particularly in the LGBT community, there was some real resistance. People hadn't read the book, and they were resistant even to the idea of it. One editor wrote a column saying, "I will not read this book," and encouraging other people not to read it too. But what's happened over time, as people have been reading the book and judging for them, you know, forming opinions based on the book itself, that's actually been changing. Because at the beginning, I started out, I believe, there were two or three LGBT journalists that spoke positively about the book, and that number has been expanding gradually, and will continue to expand based on the interviews I'm doing. More and more people have been coming out, including Lambda Literary Review, a woman by the name of Kate Sossin. There's someone writing an article in D.C. right now, Lou Whittington, who is here tonight, who wrote early on very positively about the book. And, you know, Andrew Sullivan, there have been a number of people that have written positively about the book. But the biggest disjuncture has been between what has been online and what has happened at these events. Because, as I said, I've traveled the whole country, and the conversations have been very productive, constructive, very interesting everywhere I've gone. The only place where there was a little bit of a hostile reaction was in Washington, D.C. at the beginning of the tour. There was a man who was directing the Laramie Project at Ford's Theater, and he got up and spoke, and he had not read the book, and he said he hadn't read the book, but he had a lot to say to me publicly, even though he hadn't read the book. So there were two people in Washington, D.C. That was it, and that was at the beginning of the tour. So there's been this funny disjuncture between, there's an online group called Media Matters for America, which I find a really ironic name for the kind of journalism they do. But they dogged me, and they probably wrote six or seven articles, but not one of the articles actually focused on reporting in the book and actually took something apart that I had written and offered contrary information that could refute what I said. So online, there was some noise, but everywhere I went, and I just I was in Laramie on February 4th, and that was my first appearance. The book came out October 1st, and I didn't get to Laramie till February 4th, mainly because they hadn't invited me till then. But it was a freezing night. It was about, I don't know, 7 or 10 below zero, and a couple of hundred people came out, and it was recorded for C-SPAN. And during the Q&A and comments, and there were a lot of comments, not one person in Laramie refuted the findings in the book. In fact, they were thanking me for having written the book. And they were not; these were not homophobes standing up. They were people that, you know, one of the people got up and said, you know, he was one of the owners of the Fireside Bar where Aaron and Russell met up with Matthew on that horrible night of October 6, 1998. And he said, as soon as the police started investigating the people that worked in the bar, we told the police that this was about drugs, that it wasn't about this, and they just chose not to go that in that direction.
When you were doing your research on methamphetamines,
yes.
Was there a correlation between the gay community and the party scene and methamphetamines? There was a time, I think years ago, where it was considered that methamphetamines were a party drug. Or was it just widespread usage of methamphetamines?
Well, yes, it was definitely a party drug, a circuit party drug used because, again, it keeps you up and you want to just stay up all night and you still have lots of energy to keep dancing at 7 the next morning. What is, if I may be for a moment a little bit more cynical, in the research I did around the drug business, if you know anything, methamphetamine has been around for a long time, but it really dropped. It disappeared for a long time. It was a drug that the Hells Angels were involved at one point. But what happened is the Mexican dealers, the Mexican cartels, who had been middlemen for the cocaine dealers from Colombia, they were the middlemen who were moving the drug into the United States. And when the Mexicans realized they could manufacture methamphetamine and not be the middlemen anymore and make a lot of money, they essentially took over that business and really built it up and grew it. What's interesting is the populations that got targeted. I mentioned earlier rural and small town American communities. It moved initially through the Midwest and West, but it's now a problem in the South. It's a problem. It's been a problem in the Northwest, in Oregon, other places, California certainly. But when I began to realize that another community that was targeted, Native American reservations, there's been a huge problem on the Navajo Reservation in the Southwest, on the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming, really vulnerable populations. And in that sense, while yes, it was a circuit party drug, I think people that are involved seriously in the manufacture and distribution of a drug like methamphetamine, which is probably the worst drug we've seen, and everything I've read certainly worse than heroin, cocaine, and other things, that I think it's a very calculated business decision about the populations that are going to use it and consume it.
I'm curious to know, while working on this project, were you ever personally threatened or in danger because you went too far or too deep or were probing too much?
Yes, I can actually answer that question with a short passage from the book. But where is my host? How am I on time? I'm just going to get a quick time check. Two more questions. May I answer your question next? I'll answer one more, and then I'll just read you a short passage. Would that be okay? Okay. Who? It's another question. Yes.
Hi. Now that the book is out and the truth, as we've heard it called, is out, what do we do with the Laramie Project? What do we do with this concept that has taken over in teaching children about tolerance?
Well, thank you for asking that question, and it's a difficult question for me to answer, but I'll try. The Laramie Project has certainly helped raise awareness about issues of bigotry and prejudice, etc. There's no doubt that it has done that. You know, I've seen it several times. I saw the first production at the Denver Theater Center. There are some problems I have with it because there's an awful lot, especially the first part, that is left out. I don't write about this in the book, but I did learn that some of the creators of the Laramie Project, that they were aware of a number of things that I later became aware of. In the book, I quote two sources. They are credited in the HBO version of the Laramie Project, and both of these sources gave lengthy interviews to the Laramie Project, and they told them that Matthew Shepard and Aaron McKinney had been part of the same meth party circle in Laramie. So that was an editorial and a creative decision not to include that. And I've heard other stories about the process of creating it. The second part of the Laramie Project, the epilogue, I'm much less patient with, because this is in the face of, they call it the epilogue, it's part two. And specifically, although they don't mention me by name, they attempt to discredit my reporting that I did in the ABC News 2020 piece and laugh off the idea that methamphetamine had anything to do with this. And I think that is irresponsible, because if you're serious about dealing with these kinds of tragedies, something like this that ends in violence, then it behooves all of us to look into the complexities that cause a crime of this horrific nature. And so it bothers me that they had an opportunity in the second part. The first part was written very early on, soon after the crime happened, and it was produced. But as new information came out, I think that really they were, in a sense, protecting their own agenda. And that troubles me some. The underlying message is a really good message, but it's not the only lesson to be gleaned from this tragedy. There are other lessons. For young people and what young people grapple with and what this tragedy was really about, which was, yes, a tragedy for Matthew, but it was a tragedy for a lot of other people that were involved. Let me just give you a short passage here. Okay, this is a short chapter, chapter 19, Sleeping Dogs. On a Friday afternoon in late October 2004, a little more than 6 years after the murder, I drove 200 miles to meet Kyle, a former drug cohort of Aaron McKinney, alone at an isolated truck stop off I-80 in western Wyoming. I had interviewed Kyle twice before in prison, and he had been surprisingly cooperative, so I felt more or less safe. Still, I took precautions, since he had earlier advised me, "You don't know who you're dealing with," referring to his friends higher up on the drug-dealing food chain. Kyle worked in the oil fields and had just gotten off a shift. He was still in company overalls, his face and hands stained with crude. As we sat in the front seat of his parked car talking about Matthew Shepard, whom he had previously claimed to know only in passing, I suggested that Matthew might have gotten in over his head with drugs. Kyle snarled at me like I was an idiot, yeah, and he was taking stuff away from the rest of us. Without warning, two other vehicles suddenly backed into spaces on both sides of us, wedging us in. When I saw what was happening, I leapt from the car and ran into the middle of the parking lot where there were more lights. Kyle shouted for me to get back in the car, but I refused. At that instant, a friend of mine who was planted in a nearby truck monitoring the meeting called my cell phone. "Get out of there, Steve," he yelled. "They're setting you up." "Stay in your car. Don't let them see you," I snapped back, trying not to panic but worried I would get run over or shot. I spun around several times to keep Kyle's car in view as I hustled across the parking lot to a truck stop restaurant. Before I reached the entrance, Kyle's vehicle and the other two tore out of the lot, tires screeching, heading for the ramp to the interstate. Seconds later, my friend picked me up in front of the truck stop, his face a sickly shade of white. In a halting voice, he told me how close he thought he had come to losing me there. I knew he was right. With his help, I had narrowly managed to escape, but clearly I had been given a message. Driving away from the truck stop, I took my friend's advice and crouched down on the floor of his truck out of sight. Evidently, someone more powerful than Kyle had set me up. I hardly slept that night in Laramie. Waves of anxiety surged through me till late the next morning. Why had I put myself in danger like that? The next day, still agitated, I related my roadside experience to Cal Ruruka. He shook his head in disgust. The methamphetamine trade has made Wyoming revert to the lawless anarchy of the Old West, he remarked pungently. It's deadly. By then, Cal had been voted out of office in Albany County after four elected terms. He was now prosecuting state and federal drug cases in the Twin Cities of Rock Springs and Green River, the epicenter of methamphetamine traffic for the Rocky Mountain West. After hearing my story, Cal told me about a colleague, a Wyoming judge, who had recently been surprised by an armed male intruder in the bathroom of his home one morning while shaving. The man was there to relay a message regarding a drug case in which he was awaiting sentencing by the judge. After a few curt words, the man quietly slipped away. I saw no point in asking what the judge decided with a gun staring him in the face. But Cal's reference to the Old West brought back a conversation I'd recently had about Matthew's murder with a veteran cop in the Albany County Sheriff's Office. Friendly, with a studied good old boy charm, the cop leaned over his desk toward me, his chiseled, wind-burned face inches from mine. "You sure you're not quoting me on this?" he asked. "It's for background. I won't be using your name," I answered, trying to sound reassuring. "What happened to Matthew Shepard wasn't a hate crime, not at all," he confided in a low voice. "But why do you want to go digging into all that again? Why not let sleeping dogs lie?" I wasn't inclined to answer his question candidly. Instead of laying out my suspicions about the involvement of other parties beyond Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson in events surrounding Matthew's murder, I reminded him that the killing was a seminal national event, a lot like the civil rights killings of the 1960s, as if he were somehow unfamiliar with the stigma that continued to tarnish his hometown. "The public has a right to know whether the murder was really a hate crime," I said with conviction, "and if not, what was it?" The cop stared at me as he sank back from his desk, shrugging doubtfully. Almost as an afterthought, he flashed me another knowing grin, but again, his eyes told me to let sleeping dogs lie.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.